This podcast is brought to you by The Shift.
It's story time!
Hello and welcome back to the Storytime Podcast. My name is Claire. I go by Clizaire on the internet, and this is the podcast where guests come on to tell me their stories. And this week I have with me Jeff Deskovic. Hello, Jeff.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm great. I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So would you like to introduce yourself to the audience, tell them where they can find more about you, more follow you on the internet, all that jazz?
Absolutely. Sure. So I have a website, www.deskovic.org. That's D-E-S-K-O-V-I-C .org. So they can find me there. There's a web form that people can email me through. I have a public figure page on Facebook. I'm on Instagram and LinkedIn. You can learn more about me through a documentary short, which is available on Amazon Prime called Conviction, which is about my advocacy and life post-exoneration. I am the founder of the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice, which has as its mission freeing wrongfully convicted people and pursuing policy changes aimed at preventing that from happening and doing some broader criminal justice reform. To date, we have been able to free 11 wrongfully convicted people who were incarcerated, which is to say they were incarcerated for crimes that they did not commit. We helped to pass 3 laws. I'm an advisory board member of the coalition group It Could Happen to You, which the foundation is part of, where we passed an additional 5 laws. We are currently doing policy work in New York, California, and Pennsylvania, 3 states in the United States. I'm an attorney. I have a master's degree in criminal justice as well. My thesis is on wrongful conviction causes and reform. And I got started with all of this advocacy work because I myself spent 16 years in prison from a 17 to 32 for a murder and rape, which I did not commit and that I was ultimately exonerated of through DNA testing. And now this is now my life mission.
Yes. So that is the story you're here to tell us about on the podcast today. And also, I just want to say that is the best introduction I've ever had in the history of the podcast. That was brilliant.
I'm kind of practiced at doing intros and, you know, elevator pitch and being really concise and, you know, precise and efficient with language.
Yeah. So feel free to start wherever you want to start on your story.
Sure. Absolutely. So in terms of my story, the year was 1990 and the location was Peekskill, which was in Westchester County, New York. It was suburban. It was middle class. It was ethnically diverse. I kind of lived a double life as a kid. I didn't really think of it that way then, but it's really what it was. So after school and the apartment complex where I lived at, and, you know, there were a lot of kids that lived there and in the surrounding areas, and I would be kind of like one of the main kids that whatever I would suggest would be what we would do. So if we're going to ride bikes or play basketball or play Monopoly or go watch a movie or go play video games or any number of other sports, we even had games that we even invented and created, you know, but that was kind of after school. But in school, you know, the kids were a little bit older than me, and I really wasn't into drinking and partying or organized sports. And so I didn't quite fit in there. And so a classmate who was in 2 of my classes as a freshman, 1 as a sophomore, knew her name. She knew mine. We were really not even on a high buy basis. You know, she was found murdered and raped. And Peekskill was a small city. And so this really set off an atmosphere of fear, rumor, paranoia. You know, there were town hall meetings set up on the topic of progress of investigation and safety tips. Parents were bringing their kids straight to school and then bringing them straight back home. So I got on the police radar because some of the students that the police interviewed told the police they might want to speak with me because I didn't quite fit in. And another thing was that I was a sentimental teenager. And I had an emotional reaction to this. And the police thought that my emotional reaction was something weird about that. They thought that was some sort of outward sign, like I was sorry for what I had done.
So did you know this girl?
Depends on what you mean by the word no. I mean, I knew her name. She knew mine. She was in a couple classes as a freshman, 1 as a sophomore. But, I mean, we didn't talk. We didn't hang out. We weren't friends. I certainly wasn't dating her or anything like that. So for lastly, the police got a psychological profile from the NYPD, which claimed to have the psychological characteristics of the actual perpetrator. And I had the misfortune of matching that profile. So all those factors were how I was on the police radar. So for about 6 weeks, the police played this cat and mouse game with me, in which half the time they would speak to me as if I was a suspect, and the other half the time they would pretend like they needed my help to solve the crime.
They would say things like, did you know that they suspected you? Were you really confused?
I was confused because they would start out asking me questions like they thought I was the perpetrator. But then when they would push too hard and I would become frightened and want to get away from them, that's when they would switch it up. And Jeff is this junior detective helper theme was what they created. So they would ask me, they would tell me, the kids won't talk freely around us. They will around you. Stop in from time to time. Let us know if you hear anything. They would ask me opinion questions and congratulate me like my opinions were correct. Prior to being a teenager, I wanted to be a cop when I grew up. And so that was how they were able to pull the wool over my eyes, along with my age, because I was 16.
I was about to ask you, what age were you at this time? 16. Yeah, that's really young.
Absolutely. So eventually, and the other thing too is I came from a single parent household. My father was never involved in my life in any aspect. And that intersected with the good cop, bad cop technique when one officer was pretending to be my friend. So I began to look up to him as a father figure. So eventually they got me to agree to take a lie detector test by telling me, we have some new information in the file. We want to share that with you. And that will allow you to be more helpful to us. But first you have to take and pass this polygraph. So the next day, rather than go to school, I went to the police station for the test. My mother and grandmother thought I was in school, so they didn't call around looking for me. They drove me to the town of Brewster, which was in Putnam County, whereas I was from Peekskill in Westchester County. So it was 40 minutes away by car, which meant I was totally dependent upon the police.
That's kind of crazy that they didn't insist your parents knew where you were.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, at the same time, I mean, when you're in the U.S., when you're 16 years old, you are allowed to waive your rights and speak to the police without a parent or an attorney being present.
Oh, okay. Didn't know that.
So they, in driving me to Brewster, there were three police officers that came with me from Peekskill. Of course, they put me in the car by myself with the good cop pretending to be my friend. Yeah. The other two are following. So I don't have an attorney present. They don't give me anything to eat. The polygraphist was dressed like a civilian. He never identified himself as a police officer, so he never read me my rights. And as I mentioned, they didn't give me anything to eat. There's no attorney there. They gave me a four-page brochure, which purported to explain how the polygraph worked. But I didn't understand it because it had a lot of big words in it. But then I figured, well, what does it matter? I'm here to help the police, so let's just get on with it.
You didn't understand you were being.
From there, they put me in. So from there, they put me in a small room, and he gave me countless cups of coffee to get me nervous. And then he launched into his third degree tactic. So he invaded my personal space. He raised his voice at me. He kept asking me the same questions over and over again. And as each hour passed, my fear increased in proportion to the time. And he kept that up for 6.5 to 7 hours. From there.
Oh, my God.
And then at the end, he said, what do you mean you didn't do it? You just told me through the test that you did. We just want you to verbally confirm it. And then the officer came in the room who had been pretending to be my friend. And he said, the other officers are going to harm you. I've been holding them off. I can't do this any longer. You have to help yourself. Just tell them what they want to hear. You can go home afterwards. You're not going to be arrested. Being young, naive, frightened, 16 years old, not thinking about the long term. I was only concerned my safety in the moment. I was in fear of my life because the fact that I didn't know where I was and no one else knew where I was either loomed very large in my mind. I was overwhelmed emotionally and psychologically. And then there's this possibility of harm and then also this false life preserver that he threw me. So I made up a story based on the information which he had given me in the course of the interrogation and the 6 weeks run up. By the time it was said and done, I collapsed onto the floor in a fetal position, crying uncontrollably. And obviously I was arrested I was charged with a murder and rape.
That, is that not like the textbook definition of a coerced confession or whatever the term is?
It is. That is the term. And yes, it is.
That, see, wow. And then so it went to court, presumably, did it?
It did. It did. It went to trial. So before the trial, results of a DNA test came in from the FBI lab, which showed that semen on the victim did not match me. And that's when the prosecutor got the medical examiner to commit fraud. He suddenly claimed, after the DNA didn't match me, he said, oh, I remember that I forgot to document medical evidence that showed that the victim had been promiscuous, which is what allowed the prosecutor to argue that was why the semen didn't match me, but yet I was still guilty. Taking it a step further, he named another youth by name that he claimed had slept with the victim, but he never tried to prove that. He never holds him as a witness. He never had him give a DNA sample. He just made the unsupported argument to the jury.
Also, that's kind of crazy, though, isn't it? Because, like, even if the victim was promiscuous, it's not like she would have had sex with two people in a row. So, they, like, showers exist. Like, there wouldn't have been anybody else's other than the killer sitting on her. That's crazy.
Absolutely. And he got away with that because of two factors. So, firstly, the victim's family was not coming to court. And so they had no idea of what was being said about her in the courtroom, that they were basically trashing her reputation in order to wrongfully convict me. And the second thing was that my attorney basically didn't defend me. He didn't call my alibi as a witness. He literally asked no questions of this medical examiner. I had a public defender. Yeah. No, I had a public defender. We couldn't afford a private attorney. So yeah. He literally never asked the medical examiner any questions. He never explained to the jury the significance of the DNA not matching me. He never used that to argue that proved that the confession was coerced and false. He rarely met with me. When he did meet with me and I tried to explain I was innocent and what happened in the interrogation room, he was always shutting me up. One time he told me he didn't care if I was guilty or innocent. He should have never represented me because of a conflict of interest, because this other youth that the prosecutor was falsely saying had slept with the victim was represented by another member of the public defender's office, and specifically by the lawyer who was supposed to be supervising him on my case. So that conflict prevented us, the defense, from asking him for a sample. It prevented the defense from calling him as a witness.
Oh, my God.
Lastly,
this is awful. But this is awful to hear, because, like, obviously you're 16 and you know all this now, but you obviously didn't know any of this then.
I knew none of it then. I was 16 when I was arrested. I turned 17 at the time the trial started, and I was completely in over my head. I didn't understand. I barely understood really what was going on in the courtroom. But the other aspects that I want to quickly mention in terms of the trial are that the interrogation was not videotaped. There was no audio. There was no audio tape. There was no signed confession.
No.
It was just the cop's word for it. And they left the threat and false promise out of their story.
Of course they did.
And my lawyer wouldn't allow me to testify. So when you defend a case where there's a false confession, you have to answer the confession. You have to explain the confession. You have to disprove the confession, bringing it all true together in your closing argument. But he didn't do any of that. Sometimes he argued to the jury the confession never happened. Other times he was arguing that it happened, but it was coerced. That other times he argued it happened, but it was false. So by taking this scattershot approach, obviously he must have been, it would have been too confusing
for the jury.
So a couple of irregularities happened in the course of the trial, as if all of that wasn't bad enough. The general rule is that polygraph is not allowed into the courtroom because it's not reliable. It's not scientific. In fact, even intelligence agents are trained to beat the polygraph. So that tells you all you need to know about that. And plus, frightened, innocent people can fail it.
Yeah, so I thought they weren't allowed. Or is that since?
No. It's not allowed unless both sides agree. We didn't agree, but the judge created this backdoor rule. He said, well, because this confession happened while you were being polygraphed, he allowed this polygraphist to repeatedly tell the jury that I failed the polygraph. Then the victim's clothes, including her bra, had been admitted into evidence. And that intersected with one of the statements they coerced out of me, where I said I ripped her bra off. So there's some bras you can't rip off of a body. So the jury asked to see the bra. And that's when the court said, well, the clothes, including this bra, had been left in the courtroom over the weekend. And the janitors apparently thought that it was garbage, so they threw it out. Lastly, the jury sent a note out to the judge on the third day of deliberations asking the judge, if we can't come up with a verdict, are we going to be sequestered over the Christmas holiday? And the judge answered yes. And so I've learned since then that at that point, it was 11-1 for conviction. There was a holdout juror. He didn't believe that I was guilty.
But the rest of them wanted to go home for Christmas.
Yes, exactly. And so the end result of it all was I was wrongfully convicted of a murder and rape, which I did not commit. I had been charged as an adult, tried as an adult, and I was therefore sentenced as an adult. I was given a 15-to-life sentence. Even though the judge said to me, maybe you are innocent, he didn't overturn the conviction. He sentenced me anyway, and I was sent to a men's maximum security prison.
Oh my God, that's an awful lot of injustices in the one in a row. I can't, like, yeah, it nearly feels like you're telling me the plot to a movie. I can't believe this is something that actually has happened to somebody in real life.
Yeah, it seemed it was a lot of things that happened in order to culminate into that result, but it gets worse. It gets worse. So I appealed my conviction. And I'll walk you through the process by which I lost 7 appeals. I went to the first court, the appellate division. My lawyer argued the statements were involuntary. She argued that I was innocent based on the DNA, that there wasn't legally sufficient evidence to convict me, that the prosecution hadn't proven guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, that their verdict was against the weight of the evidence. She raised the issue of the polygraphist repeatedly telling the jury that I failed, while prohibiting my attorney from questioning him about the methods he used to arrive at his opinion. The issue of the evidence being thrown out was raised. A total of 10, and the issue of the judge being biased was raised. A total of 10 different issues were raised. So the appellate division wrote that I was free to come and go as I wanted, and therefore the statements were voluntary. They wrote that there was overwhelming evidence of guilt, which doesn't make any sense because the DNA doesn't match me. They got rid of every other issue in one sentence. They wrote, we've looked at the rest of the issues and found them to either be without merit or not preserved for review. And then they ruled against me 5-0. And it was all downhill from there. The re-argument motion in front of that court was denied, in one word, denied. The New York Court of Appeals, the highest court in the state, declined to give me permission to appeal to them. So I lost there that way. I lost in federal court because my attorney was given the wrong information by the court clerk, which resulted in my petition arriving 4 days too late. So the DA, the district attorney urged the court to just rule that I was late and dismiss my case. And that's what the court did. I challenged that ruling at the Federal Court of Appeals, where future U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor was on the bench with her colleague, Rosemary Pooler. And my lawyer argued that this was not a delay caused by me or my attorney, but by the misinformation by the court clerk, that upholding a ruling like that would cause a miscarriage of justice to continue, and that reversing the procedural ruling would open the door to more sophisticated testing. And again, the DA opposed, and again, the court ruled with the district attorney. The re-argument motion there was denied, and then the U.S. Supreme Court declined to give me permission to appeal to them. So that's 7 appeals that I've lost now, and now I'm permanently locked out of the court unless I could find some new evidence. So that meant because I didn't have an attorney or an investigator, I couldn't afford to hire one, I began this letter writing campaign looking for somebody to take my case pro bono. So I wrote 4 letters for 4 years, rarely getting a response other than the occasional no. I went to the parole board where, because I maintained my innocence rather than expressing remorse and taking responsibility, they declined to parole me. They told me, come back in 2 years. So I wound up doing that's 15 years already now. So I wound up doing one more year. So the following things happened, which resulted in my being exonerated. So firstly, one of the letters that I wrote in care of the, to a book author in care of the publishing company, was instead sent to an investigator. And when she saw the DNA didn't match me, she was convinced of my innocence. And she tried to get people to take my case. And one of her ideas was the winning one. She suggested I write the Innocence Project again, which represents wrongfully convicted prisoners across the country where DNA testing could demonstrate innocence. So I had wrote them before, but back then they would just test evidence and then introduce the results as newly discovered evidence. That was not an option because it wasn't new. The jury knew that the test excluded me. So fast forwarding 15 years, the investigator said, while the DNA data bank has been created, so the prior denial is irrelevant, just apply again. She lobbied them outside the organization to take my case. She got several other respected legal entities to take my case. And then I got lucky that one of the intake workers, Maggie Taylor, when the lawyers at the Innocence Project again did not want to take my case because of the DNA not matching me like ahead of time, she presented my case a total of 3 times, getting them to finally accept it. So getting their representation was the first key. Second key was the Westchester District Attorney at the time, Janine Pirro, who was not the DA when I was convicted, but she took office before the first appeal was decided. So she fought all the appeals and blocked me from getting further testing. She left office and her successor was willing to let me get the testing. And thirdly, we got lucky that the actual perpetrator's DNA was in the DNA database. So when we took that crime scene DNA that did match me and it was entered into the database, it matched the actual perpetrator whose DNA was only there because left free while I was doing time for his crime, he had killed a second victim 3.5 years later, who was a school teacher and had 2 children.
Oh my God.
So on September 22nd, 2006, the conviction was overturned. I was released. Went back to court November 2nd, 2006, at which point all the charges against me were dismissed on actual innocence grounds. And he was arrested, charged, and convicted of the crime.
15 years is an awful long time to spend in prison.
16, sorry.
And you were 17 when you were convicted. So that's like a huge chunk of your early life that was spent in prison. So how was, just to try and understand it from an outside perspective, like, what is that like?
Culture was different. Technology was different. So cell phones, GPS, internet had not yet been created. Cities and towns looked different. And the people I knew that lived there looked different, were had been moved. So taken cumulatively, there was it felt like I was in a parallel world that I didn't belong in. I was released with nothing. It took 5 years before I was compensated. So I was always passed over for gainful employment. So I lacked stability of housing. I bounced around from place to place. At one point, I was a couple of weeks away from the homeless shelter. And then Mercy College gave me a scholarship to finish the bachelor's degree, which I was 10 classes short of finishing.
Sorry, go back to that for a second. So was it from lack of experience that you were struggling to find a job, was it? Or was your previous status impacting that, even though you'd been declared as innocent?
Both of them were. In fact, there were some employers that turned me down. They said, well, they were concerned, well, how would their other employees react to me? Were they going to get people protesting outside of their business? You know, those were all concerns that they cited.
Right. So this idea that you get exonerated, it doesn't immediately fix the problem because you have there's a big change to go through and you are still getting discriminated against because of the fact that you've been in prison. Wow.
Yes, exactly.
I'm sorry. Keep going. You went back to your BA?
So I got a scholarship from Mercy College to complete the bachelor's degree because I had gotten GED and completed associates and was a year towards the bachelor's while incarcerated before funding was cut for college education for prisoners. So Mercy College gave me a scholarship to finish the bachelor's degree. And when I lost my temporary housing, I was a couple of weeks away from the homeless shelter, they agreed to allow me to live on campus. So that was how I avoided that. I wound up getting a master's degree from John Jay College of Criminal Justice. My thesis was written on wrongful conviction causes and reform. But the other challenges, though, aside from that, we talked about the stigma and we talked about the employment aspect, but there was also the psychological after effects. So it's common for people to have PTSD, panic attacks, anxiety, feeling of being frozen in time, feeling of processing things at a slower speed. Then beyond that, it was I had repair relations with my extended family, the overwhelming majority of which had never come to see me. So I knew who they were intellectually from memories when I was younger. But, you know, I was a different person now, and so were they. So it was, you know, and it was very lonely, actually. And so it was a really difficult 5 years. But at the same time, when I was released, I gave an off-the-cuff presentation to the media at the press conference, holding them for two and a half hours, at which point everything I'd ever wanted to say in 16 years but could never get anybody to hear me say all came out. And I realized I could be an advocate at that point. So while I was experiencing all those difficulties, I was simultaneously, I became an individual advocate. So I was doing speaking engagements. I became a weekly columnist for a newspaper. And I was doing regular media interviews and I was meeting with elected officials. So I did that for about 5 years. And then I was compensated and I decided that I wanted to take my advocacy work to the next level. So I took $1.5 million from that and started the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice for the purpose of continuing the policy work and public education piece to that, but also the freeing people. So hence us being able to free 11 people, and we got three laws changed. And then as part of the bigger group called It Could Happen to You, which I'm an advisory board member of and which the foundation is part of, we're able to pass five additional laws, and there are chapters now in New York, Pennsylvania, and California, which I'm active in all three. But at some point, it became not enough for me to sit in the front row of the courtroom. I wanted to be able to sit at the defense table and represent some of the clients, hence my becoming an attorney.
Yeah, so you're an attorney now.
I am.
And so how do you come across your clients?
Sure, so the people apply to the foundation. So I'm only interested in doing wrongful conviction work. I'm only interested in freeing people who are wrongfully imprisoned and helping them get compensated afterwards. So the foundation as a whole has 10 active cases now, and I've entered some of those cases as co-counsel, you know, and the extra credential of being an attorney helps push the policy reforms that I'm working on. So currently, we are looking to build our donor base. You know, so my ultimate dream is to have a chapter of the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice in each state and ultimately in each country, because I see wrongful conviction as a worldwide issue, not an American problem. And countries who really don't hear about wrongful conviction, it's not because they're not happening, it's because there's not a lot of people doing the exonerative work. So people aren't getting exonerated, you know, but that's going to be as public support allows us to do it. So we are always on, I'm always on the lookout for large donors, small donors, corporations that engage in corporate philanthropy, people that have a higher public profile or even higher social media profile. Maybe they would shoot a short video talking about wrongful conviction and the foundation. We do have a Patreon page. So that it's a crowdfunding page. It's for people who are willing to be recurring monthly donors. So imagine if, say, for example, 25,000 people decided that they were willing to help free wrongfully convicted people by donating $3 to $5 or any amount they could afford on a recurring monthly basis. You know, that would give us the funds we needed to.
Yeah,
we could hire additional attorneys, investigators, paralegals. We could work on more cases. So we have 7 cases that are approved that we don't have the capacity to move right now. They're just waiting. So imagine if, you know, we had that additional capacity and we could pursue additional policy changes. So that's definitely a way that people could help. Amazon has the Amazon Smile program. So if you register for the Jeffrey Deskwick Foundation as your charity of choice, they will donate a small amount of your purchase without it increasing the cost to the consumer. So if people are out there and they like our work, they could, you know, sign up for the Patreon, they could sign up for Amazon Smile and also help promote it on social media, word of mouth. I need a lot of people helping what I do. I do want to share that I work 50 to 60 hours a week doing this type of work. I don't get paid for it. So none of the money would be coming to my pocket under any line of reasoning, and all would go 100% to freeing people who are wrongfully imprisoned and the policy work and the broader justice reform that we push.
Can I ask you, mentioned that you got compensated.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. And so was that hard to get? Was it?
Yes.
I mean,
it was hard to get. It took five years. It took 5 years, you know, before I got anything. And, you know, I didn't let anybody go that was involved in it. And so all in all, it took about 8 years for everything to finish.
Wow.
So I settled with everybody except for the polygraphist, and I went to trial against him, and I won a jury verdict against him as well.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And so is that something that you help the people you exonerate with, or do they work with other people then? Because I presume everybody who gets exonerated needs to be then compensated.
Well, everybody who's exonerated needs to be compensated. Yeah, sure. But I mean, there are 14 states in the U.S. that do not currently offer compensation. Pennsylvania is one of them. That's one of the states where myself and my other colleagues from Pennsylvania, could happen to you, are working to build support right now to ultimately pass that. So in terms of where people go to get compensated, I mean, most of the time people that are exonerated, they stay with the lawyer that exonerated them if they offer that service. But, you know, certainly I help people that, you know, that are come to me and look for that. And, you know, it is a way I could earn some money on the back end, some of which would be, I would further donate into the organization to help free additional people. Yeah. Well,
that's really interesting. Actually, that's a real life example of a law or something that you are trying to institute that will be really impactful. You're trying to institute compensation in states where there isn't any, like Pennsylvania. That's really, wow. I mean, it's really, what you're doing is really impactful. And I totally understand it was an awful experience, but you've really changed people's lives now as a result of it.
Absolutely. Listen, this is my mission in life. This is how I make sense of what happened to me. I think, you know, I feel at peace with that, you know, and I have my mission. I have my purpose. I'm not an angry person. I mean, I want to enjoy life as much as I can. I want to, I feel like I lost so much already. Why would I want to give over the rest of my life? And if I was to be angry or bitter, it's not like I would be harming anybody that was involved in what happened to me. I would really be the only loser in that scenario.
Yeah.
So I take the energy that I would feel, and I channel it into the advocacy work that I do.
Wow. Do you want to quickly remind everyone of the website and where they can go to find you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, www.deskovic.org, DESKOVIC. And again, I do have a public figure page on Facebook. I do have Instagram and LinkedIn, and you can message me that way. The website, as I mentioned, does have a web form. You could email me through there. And so if anyone's out there listening that can help in any way, please don't hesitate to reach out to me. I mean, certainly to bring about the goal of having a chapter in each country, each state in the U.S. and each country, I would need all the help that I can possibly get. And if you're listening out there, there are some life lessons quickly that I want to share from my struggles, both in wrongfully imprisoned, reintegration, the difficult process of becoming a lawyer, everything. So I found that this formula works, that you have a goal, have a realistic plan, be flexible. So remember that the plan, the goal is the goal. The plan's not the goal. So if a different door opens for you, there's another way to move forward for that other than what you planned. As long as it brings you towards the goal and it's something you're comfortable with, be flexible. Have the mindset that there are no reasons why you can't accomplish something, only reasons why it might be more difficult. Don't be afraid of doing a lot of hard work. If you really want something, to use a sports term, leave it all out on the field and never give up. And when you can't go on any further, just say to yourself, this might be the key moment where you're on the verge of a breakthrough, but because you quit, it's not going to happen. So now just keep going forward, even though you can't anymore, just to see what happens on the other end. And when you do come out on the other side, reach back for people in the same position you were in, do some work on the preventative side, and it'll make your suffering count for something. It'll be healing, meaningful, cathartic, make the world a little bit better. And I know that those lessons apply far beyond imprisonment, wrongful conviction. That could apply to someone who's a domestic abuse survivor, or someone that's survived sexual assault, or someone who's been homeless, or somebody who, say, has gone through some kind of debilitating illness, someone that's been discriminated against, someone that's faced racism, or anything else you want to plug in of tremendous magnitude down to the smallest challenge. That's kind of a universal way of going about it. And if I was to know, you know, that people were to act on that and overcome some situation, that would, wow, that really would be no words for that situation. That would really, really make my heart feel good. And yeah, so this is me, and just, you know, making my way in the world and trying to make my difference and walk in a way that's, you know, meaningful, pleasing to God. And, you know, at the same time, my head still fits these headphones. You know, my feet are still firmly on the floor. I'm just me. I'm just Jeff. You know, I'm just a tool in the struggle. That's all. Just doing the best that I can. And you know, to me, that's really important part of it.
I absolutely love that advice of when you're through it, reach back to somebody who was in your position. That's really amazing advice.
And if I could just remind people one more time as well, please, if you'd like to see more about my advocacy work in life post-exoneration, please check out Conviction, which is available on Amazon Prime.
Yes, I'm going to go watch that, actually. That's amazing that there's a documentary about you on Amazon Prime.
Yeah, and then in that documentary, I tried to use that platform that I had to raise attention for some of the non-innocence criminal justice reform issues, things like people being returned back to prison for a year or two on a technical parole violation. Imagine going back to prison because your curfew was 8 o'clock and you got home at 8:10 or 8:05. And I talk about elderly people in prison and compassionate release and the medical care and the need for parole reform and to try to reduce the violence in prison and to get rid of the verbal abuse of the guards towards the prisoners. So, you know, lack of college education in prisons, which, you know, such a wonderful reform tool, rehabilitative tool that they took away. In U.S., there's 68% recidivism rate, but for college-educated prisoners, much lower, which really makes sense because if you expand people's horizons, if you equip them for gainful employment, much better chance at getting a meaningful job and rather than just falling back into old ways. So that's the thing that I'm most happiest about, the way that Conviction came out. You know, the producer and director, Gia, where she, you know, let that stuff. I decided what I was going to say on camera. You know, she was involved completely in the creative process as far as what would ultimately make the cut. And so that's the thing I'm most proud of about Conviction. And in terms of reentry, last thing I'll mention is I do co-own a game called Recharge Beyond the Bars Reentry Game, which facilitates formerly incarcerated people with playing, with reconnecting with friends or family. So the game has icebreaker questions. So I remember my brother said to me before, I'm not sure what to say. I don't know what not to say. I don't know what to ask, what not to ask. And on my end of it, it was hard for me to communicate when I knew that nobody had been the person I was talking to had not been through incarceration or the challenge of reintegration. So Recharge steps in the middle and it poses icebreaker type questions.
That's amazing.
So people can find that at rechargethegame.com.
That's amazing. I will put all of the links that we've mentioned the whole way throughout this podcast down in the description on YouTube and in the show notes on the audio platforms. Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast to share your story.
Thank you very much for having me. And I look forward to when this is published to share the links with me. And I'll definitely promote it and encourage people to continue to, you know, tune into your podcast above and beyond simply my episode.
Yeah. And please, thank you so much for listening or watching. If you're watching on YouTube, please check out the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice and all of the links that we mentioned. If you are listening on the audio platforms as well, please give us a review. It really helps us out in the ratings and in the charts. And thanks again, Jeff. And I shall see you guys in the next one. Bye.
This podcast was brought to you by The Shift. For more like this, check out theshift.ie.